it is the reformers whose views and demands are most in line with what the United States wants to see happen in Iran.
It is undercutting the most essential democratic freedom, or certainly one of the most essential, which is the right to dissent and express your opinion.
I learned of 5 laws that give absolute immunity to U.S. military members who rape, maim, or murder their own or others. And when we got to the Supreme Court level, the Supreme Court refused to hear my case.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, June 18th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. American troops have captured Abid Hamid Mahmoud al-Tikriti, Saddam Hussein's presidential secretary and number 4 on the U.S. most wanted list of Iraqi leaders. That's according to the U.S. military. U.S. forces captured Mahmoud on Monday in Iraq, and according to U.S. Military Central Command, it did not say where in Iraq he was captured. Mahmoud was third in power only to Saddam and his younger son Qassem, and Mahmoud controlled access to Saddam and was one of the few people he is said to have trusted completely. That's according to a U.S. official who spoke on the condition of anonymity. Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas called separate meetings with leaders of the main Islamic militant groups in Gaza today to persuade them to stop attacking Israelis, pursuing his effort to establish a truce through dialogue and not the crackdown demanded by Israel. Abbas is proposing a joint political leadership, including the militant Hamas and Islamic Jihad. That's according to Ismail Abu Shanab, a Hamas representative who met with Abbas. Such a joint leadership would be headed by Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and operate under the umbrella of the PLO, according to the official Palestine Media Center. Israel and the U.S. have been trying to sideline Arafat, but he retains considerable clout and popularity. Last night, Palestinian gunmen killed a 7-year-old Israeli girl and wounded her sister in a highway ambush. A week of intense violence almost buried the U.S.-backed roadmap peace plan launched June 4th. At a Pentagon briefing earlier today, Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld was asked if he had examined the evidence of Iraq's weapons program amid concerns that the administration may have overplayed Saddam Hussein's alleged weapons of mass destruction.
I have not reviewed the matter. I do know that the intelligence has been what it has been, and it for a decade and more, and it has gotten richer every year, fuller, more robust. It is intelligence that the U.S. had, that the U.K. had. It is intelligence that was not disputed in the UN. If you'll recall, the issue wasn't whether or not the intelligence was correct by the other countries. The only issue was whether it was appropriate to wait a bit longer to allow inspections to work. What you have to appreciate is that they learned to live in an inspections environment in that country. That is to say, to be able to still function and have inspectors there in the country. And they had a very long period to hide or do whatever it is they wanted to do with those capabilities. My personal view is that that their intelligence has been, I'm sure, imperfect, but good. In other words, I think the intelligence was correct in general, and that you always will find out precisely what it was once you get on the ground and have a chance to talk to people and explore it.
Secretary of War Donald Rumsfeld responding at a Pentagon briefing earlier today. Human rights groups are strongly criticizing a federal appeals court ruling yesterday that allows the government to withhold names and other information about hundreds of Muslim immigrants rounded up after the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks in New York and at the Pentagon. New York-based Human Rights Watch warned that the decision would open the door to widespread secret detentions on immigration charges, while the American Civil Liberties Union charged that the appeals court ignored mounting evidence of government misconduct documented just 2 weeks ago in a major report by the Justice Department's Inspector General in its treatment of more than 700 detainees. Peace Watch spoke with Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, to get his opinion of the ruling.
Well, it's a ridiculous decision, and it's a sad day for really civil liberties and for civil rights in America. I mean, what it means is that basically the United States can pick people up off the street were non-citizens and probably even citizens, but certainly non-citizens, and disappear them essentially. They can not have to disclose their identities to their family, not have to disclose who their attorneys are, not give any information about them, and process them in essentially in a secret hearing, deport them or do whatever they do with them. So it's actually a terrible ruling. It puts us really on the side of what Chile did and what other countries have done. And the justifications for it, the so-called national security justification, is just completely bogus, and we can talk about that.
Well, and to set this sort of precedent of allowing secret arrests and disappearances of U.S. citizens as well as others under the auspices or the rubric of national security, and that these people perhaps pose a threat of being terrorists or posing a terrorism threat to the U.S. Any danger of that creeping further away from that narrow definition of who could be picked up, in your opinion?
Well, let's look at it first, that these people were not necessarily dangerous. These were people who their neighbor may have called because some person was out of status. They may have had something wrong with their immigration papers. Of the 776 people, or maybe 1,200, whatever numbers are used, I think none of those people were found to be any relationship to terrorism, and yet those are the very people whose names have been kept secret. So the national security, the use of national security in that context is already just so terrible as an excuse for jailing people as to be essentially unacceptable. But the question of creeping is obvious to me, and it's already, as I said, quite extensive what's happened here. But obviously, if in the name of national security you can pick up non-citizens, as most of these, if not all of these people were, and they have two citizens in jail, but those people we know. But if you can pick up non-citizens, what prevents the government from simply saying tomorrow, well, Michael Ratner coming to my house, picking me up, putting me in jail, saying national security, we can't let out his name. And the problem is that you have to have checks on a government. You can't have a government that simply goes around picking people up and doesn't give the person the right to challenge their detention in a court, in a proceeding, have that information known by people so that the person can actually defend themselves. Otherwise, you have a government that can act as it is now, I think, completely arbitrarily. It's a really serious blow to our liberty.
And we're talking about the identities of hundreds of people, not just a few, 10 or 20 people here.
That's correct, Bern. It's really hundreds, it may be even thousands. I mean, the Muslim organizations estimate that as many as 3,000 have been picked up. The government admitted in November of 2001 that it was about 1,200. Now, I don't know how many are still in there because they won't tell us.
Well, let's revisit this whole thing about national security because, of course, even the progressives are concerned that we're not, while we want to make sure that the civil liberties are being protected, there is also the legitimate concern of national security. And the court ruled that if the government were forced to release these names, that it would basically be a roadmap. A complete roadmap of the government's investigation after September 11th, and that it would allow terrorists critical information as to including which cells have been compromised and which individuals have cooperated with the U.S. Is there any valid concern along those lines that you can think of?
I think there's two points here. One is that, as I said, that these people were simply arbitrarily picked up and had no relationship to terrorism. They were part of a terrorism investigation, but they just decided to arrest Muslims who were out of status. So there isn't really much justification for that. Secondly, I think for people from Al-Qaeda, if to the extent they look at these things, obviously know who's missing. And thirdly, in my view, if you're going to use any kind of secrecy, and I'm not sure there's any justification, you have to do it, in my view, on an individual basis. You can't simply say as a blanket matter, we pick up 1,200 people in November 2001, and just as a general matter, we're going to keep every single person's name secret. What you have to do under our system of justice is have individualized determinations as to whether it's necessary. You can't simply have the government use a vague word like national security, put 1,200 people under secret orders, secret hearings, no real attorneys, et cetera. You have to have individualized hearings if you're going to even use this process, and I'm not sure there's any right to really use the process.
Well, can this be challenged further legally within the court system?
Well, the decision was, this was a circuit court decision out of D.C. It was 2-1 with a stinging dissent about this issue. There's a fair chance that, it could go to the Supreme Court of the United States. I presume they'll take it up there. But again, it's not clear the Supreme Court will hear this case. You have to remember, during the Second World War and the Japanese concentration camp cases, the Supreme Court refused actually to decide those cases. And so the people were left in those camps because they don't like to do these things during so-called national security crises or wars, et cetera. So I don't know what's going to happen to this case, but I imagine, you know, there will be an appeal, and hopefully that this blanket kind of thing will be reversed. On the other hand, we have to look at, you know, there was a similar kind of ruling on secret hearings for immigration detainees. And again, the circuit said that that was okay to do in a blanket way. So what you really see here is the courts going along with the government's excuse or the executive's rationale and not being willing to challenge it. And that's essentially what the two judges said. They said, look, this is up to the government or the executive, and we're not going to stick our hands in here. Unfortunately, that's exactly the wrong attitude. The courts are there really to measure up what the government is doing and make sure that it is complying with the law.
It seems like it's having a pretty chilling effect on civil liberties, particularly in the context of where we are politically, this so-called war on terrorism. And if we expand that to the fact that the U.S. occupation government in Iraq is now, we're reading where Paul Bremer, the U.S. appointed administrator in Iraq, has actually signed a proclamation outlawing any, quote, gatherings, pronouncement, or publications in opposition to that U.S. occupation government there. It sounds like the U.S. occupation government in Iraq is not willing to tolerate dissent of any kind.
It certainly does appear that way. Even peaceful demonstrations are relatively peaceful. I think today, Wednesday, there was a demonstration in front of the palace in Baghdad, and two Iraqis were killed. There were no guns fired, apparently, an AP reporter said. But the U.S. troops fired on them, obviously, in an effort to not just discourage, but to essentially make it impossible to demonstrate against the occupation government. So here the U.S. is supposedly on one level, I mean, essentially in my false level, but claimed that it was liberating Iraq so that people could have more democratic freedoms. And what is it doing? It is undercutting the most essential democratic freedom, or certainly one of the most essential, which is the right to dissent and express your opinion. I'm not talking about the right to shoot Americans. I'm talking about the right to express and go to demonstration and dissent against the fact that the U.S. has appointed the government, which it initially said it wasn't going to do, and those types of things. So you do have the U.S. really robbing the Iraqi people of any right of expression, which is really pretty shocking.
And how extreme is this, what we're witnessing now in the context of the history of this country with regard to civil liberties, both here in the U.S. and abroad? I mean, it seems as though this administration has taken us down a path that has never been quite ventured down before to this degree.
Bernard, I think it's the most extreme we've seen in this country. I mean, I think during the Second World War, it was obviously pretty extreme with the Japanese camps. But at that point, of course, there hadn't been an attack on the United States itself. There had been an attack in Hawaii, and there was at least going to be an end to the war. In this case, we've seen very draconian measures that will last, unfortunately, it appears now, for lifetimes, in which the U.S. has some vague war, metaphorical war against terrorism, not just against al-Qaeda, in which it's using that to justify a number of overseas adventures and a number of draconian abrogation of our rights at home. So I think it's the worst we've seen, and we can just go down the line. You can go down from First Amendment into the right to demonstrate. You can talk about the Fourth Amendment and the right to be free from government wiretapping and searches. Talk about the right to go get the fundamental one, the right to get yourself tested by a court as to whether you can be detained. And, you know, we had a recent Justice Department report that just excoriated the Justice Department itself for how it's treated these post-9/11 detainees and how it's not given them their rights, mm-hmm. how they've been beaten, how they can't get court proceedings apart from Guantanamo. So we're facing, I think, the most dire prospect we've seen in this country in terms of civil rights and civil liberties. We had today something that essentially is allowing the government to use racial profiling in its investigations, came out in the guise of a report that it shouldn't use racial profiling, and then it said except, in national security terrorism investigations. Pretty big exceptions, and you could just go on and on. So I think we're facing an extreme situation. We're partly facing it because the U.S. has a free hand in the world now. There's no one to stop it, and so that it's going to take advantage of that both abroad and at home.
So what does the average civil liberties-loving citizen do in the face of this assault?
Well, I think you have to get active. I mean, we've talked about this before, but, you know, there's some people that have had their local libraries post notices that say that any book you can take out can be discovered by the government, and what you read can be discovered. If you object to this, write or call Attorney General Ashcroft, and they basically have meetings at their libraries and get their libraries to put these things up. So there's small things like that you can do. There's getting a hold of your members of Congress and saying, you know, this is bad. Don't go Patriot 2. Go Patriot, you know, get rid of Patriot Act 1. Get your city council, which there's a fairly active move on around the country right now, to have city council resolutions passed with regard to abrogating and getting rid of most of Patriot Act 1. I think it's important to join those efforts. I think a third thing is to really express people's views, is to write op-eds and go to their newspapers, join demonstrations, be active, and don't be frightened. And now that's easier to say if you're a citizen than a non-citizen, because the brunt of what's coming down is, at this point, still on non-citizens. But I do think it's really important to express ourselves, because really to be silent in the face of this is really a crime as well.
Michael Ratner with the Center for Constitutional Rights. Any final thoughts on your part, Michael?
I just think that we're in a dire, dire moment with regard to civil rights and civil liberties. And people have to wake up to the fact that we're not being made any safer by these draconian restrictions, but we're being made less free.
Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Hundreds of Iranian students demonstrated for the eighth consecutive night tonight in seven cities across their country in opposition to government proposals to privatize public education. Scores were arrested and injured as they faced beatings from hardline Islamic vigilantes, as well as a government crackdown on protests. Back in Washington, President Bush praised the protests as a cry for freedom from an oppressed people whose government the U.S. accuses of allegedly developing nuclear weapons. But according to Ross Prezal, Washington-based political analyst and member of the Alliance of Progressive Iranians, many of the protesters don't realize that the main reformers of the Iranian government, with who they are suddenly allied, actually back future privatization efforts, which the demonstrators themselves oppose.
I want to start by saying that there is a great irony here, because the immediate trigger of the student protests is that the cost of university education may go up soon, because it is proposed that governments be privatized in Iran. And so that's what triggered the rage. However, the students, and by the way, let's understand that these are a few thousand students out of hundreds of thousands of university students in Iran who are protesting. To what extent they have support among the rest of that great mass is not clear yet. I do think their cause is legitimate. However, I also think that they're misled into thinking by other less wholesome Iranian dissidents, into thinking that if you overthrow this regime and you have secular, quote-unquote, democracy in Iran, that all ills will be remedied, unaware of the fact that Iran's foremost reformers actually advocate free market economics in Iran, which means privatization. In other words, you know, the students who are protesting the privatization of universities are actually allied with the great reform movement that totally wants to get a government out of economics, and basically the same thing that President Reagan advocated and George Bush does, the extreme right wing of the Republican Party. So there's an irony here. When we talk about democracy, we should realize how much that concept has been abused through the ages. It's nothing new. I think there's a situation, maybe perhaps if I said that this is, to me, reminiscent of Venezuela's crisis, that putting it in that framework might actually help understand it, in that the less educated classes in Iran are very suspicious, let's say, of the professional class that are leading this reform movement, and that's why you don't see the so-called masses join this movement or protest of students. I do think that everybody in Iran, great majority, do want this government to moderate its ways. However, it is the reformers whose views and demands are most in line with what the United States wants to see happen in Iran.
So what has been the official Iranian response to all of this effort on the part of the U.S. to have the U.N. inspectors have access to the nuclear facilities in Iran?
My understanding that it is that it's a cat and mouse game, that they, of course, want, if for no other reason, at least because they, of course, have their national pride and want to resist foreign interference in the internal affairs in Iran, which is legitimate. I mean, the United States does that, and many times bigger and more forcefully all the time. But on the other hand, it could be that they are also trying to hide something. It is hard to tell from distance. I think very few people know the answer. I think Iran's government is very, very afraid now of the United States, and it's going to do what the maximum that it can possibly do without letting the U.S. drive a wedge in Iran. It's going to do the maximum that it can to appease the United States, to avert trouble. It is doing that. There are many, many signs of that. They're very anxious now to negotiate with the United States. They have been very, very careful not to appear to be interfering in Iraq. They have cooperated really to a great extent in trying to track and arrest Al-Qaeda members in Iran.
Mm. Well, why do you think Iran is suddenly in the spotlight?
I don't think it's new. It's not new at all. The same people, the neoconservatives and Israel lobby, and the Christian right, by the way, we shouldn't forget that, who have advocated for more than a decade, at least a decade now, that Iraq, Iran, Syria, and in some quarters they also include Saudi Arabia and Egypt in that, that the entire Middle East, just, of course, because of its oil, the so-called extremist countries, the rogue states, whatever you want to call them, these are the enemies of civilization and modernity. They should all be overthrown or changed in some dramatic way. Basically, it's a surgical view of the world. So it's not new. The same people who arranged and laid the groundwork for attacking Iraq have been working on targeting Iran. There's some disagreement. Some said that Iran should be attacked first. Now the other ones prevailed, and Iraq was taken care of, and now Iran is next. For the same reasons, by the way. It has nothing to do with weapons of mass destruction.
It's the oil.
It's the domination of the oil market. It's not that that the oil companies are behind this trying to make more profit in the short run. That's not it. The strategic thinkers in Washington are not after the oil itself, but the leverage that it gives them to dominate the rest of the world. This is not stuff that I say. You can go to the website of the right-wing think tanks like Project for the New American Century and American Enterprise Institute and the rest, and the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs. You know, the people who push Star Wars anti-missile defense, who want to go dig up oil in Alaska, all these extreme right-wing people are tying their various agendas, and the people who want to maximize the amount of money that goes to Pentagon and so on, they've all come together. Basically, this is their moment. September 11 have given them their day, as you can see also in the case of John Ashcroft and so on. It's a very historical moment.
Ross Porzal, as an Iranian-American, have you heard anything recently from your friends and relatives back in Iran about the situation from their perspective?
Yes, I have, and it's disappointing. The domestic policies of Iran's government, unfortunately, have really divided public opinion in Iran, and that is the opportunity that the Pentagon and the White House are trying to exploit. Despite the open political conditions in Iran, the government is not willing to yield to people's demand. It's a situation sort of perhaps in some ways comparable to Cuba. People, many, many people like the government, but they would like it to be more transparent. And let me also add that just as in the case of Cuba, it's difficult for a government that's under foreign attack, that feels very unsafe and insecure, to be more transparent. because some, you know, this 800-pound gorilla is waiting outside your borders, in this case next door now in Iraq. I mean, the U.S. has become a neighbor of Iran, to basically overwhelm you. So it's a catch-22. I think that, unfortunately, I have to say, reluctantly, that there is growing enthusiasm in Iran for U.S. intervention.
Widespread?
It's very widespread, and this is a very, very important point, the most important point. That is, that sentiment is very widespread in the educated class, in the professional middle class. The people who, of course, write and speak and you hear the most about, and you always have, because, of course, they're the class that foreign reporters, international journalists and researchers and whatnot are the most in touch with. So you always hear their points of view. So to some extent, you might get an exaggerated picture of how much support there is in Iran for just having the government be overthrown at the hands of whoever, making a pact with the devil if you have to. The less educated classes who are more associated with tradition and religion, and these are the same classes who really gave rise to the revolution of 1979, they are much less enthusiastic about American intervention.
So who stands to gain most from America's intervention into Iran?
Oh, the same classes that ruled Iran before the revolution. Now there's a new mix, however. The intelligentsia, educated middle class, definitely will be the winners, and the working class will be the losers. I mean, I don't have to tell you that people in the rest of the world have this exaggerated view of how life is in America and how lucky Americans are to have so much facility in life and so on. They don't realize how people are overworked here and exploited. So if Iranians are very, very lucky, they will have a U.S.-style democracy. I don't think it will be even this good, but if they get to have their dreams, then they will have a U.S.-style democracy, and in which case the middle class will be the winner after all. And others have to just... I mean, that's the aim of globalization to begin with, is to make workers of everybody, of the great masses of people. And I'm pretty sure that it will happen sooner. This will happen in Iran sooner or later, with or without U.S. intervention. I would personally much prefer that this be left to the Iranians to work it out themselves without foreign intervention. I want an indigenous kind of democracy where the different classes will have to negotiate who gets what out of the social and economic pie. U.S. pressure will make it more lopsided.
Ross Porzal, Washington-based Iranian-American political analyst, member of the Alliance of Progressive Iranians. Any final thoughts on your part?
I think it's important to when you hear from a great many Iranians now, especially exiles, that the days of Iran's government are numbered, and that this is the beginning of the end in short order, to take that with a grain of salt. I don't think anybody knows one way or the other. I just want to point out that for the past quarter of a century, there have been many, many such jubilant proclamations every time there are riots or protests in Iran. Iranians here especially in exile are so thirsty for some good news that they believe things like that. And every time those predictions have failed, but it's a sign of how misplaced and inaccurate the analysis of the educated class is with regard to why there has been turmoil in Iran now for a century, really. It's a sign of how misguided that analysis is, that they are wrong again and again and again about the will of the masses in Iran. And this is just one more case. I don't know. In this case, maybe it will be different, but not so sure.
Ross Porzal is a Washington-based political analyst and member of the Alliance of Progressive Iranians. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment, and when we do, we'll hear from Martin Luther King III and a woman who was raped not once, not twice, but three times during her stay in the military. We'll be back in a moment.